This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 232. Of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
Because I was going to say, welcome to episode 232, Summer. And then I forgot, oh, you have to say Outlander podcast.
You do.
Oh, Lord. So how's this week been to you, Summer?
But I am the lone survivor of the Christmas crud.
Apparently. Of the Christmas crud?
Yes. Like, everybody.
I don't know what you're talking about. I'm fine. I'm fine.
We all read your tweets.
No, that was not my tweet. I don't tweet that stuff. I do Facebook. No. It's more protected.
Okay. Well, we all read your Facebook. And by we all, I mean those lucky few.
All four of you. Thank you so much. That's mom, dad, Summer, and a cousin.
Right. Just one.
It's all family.
It's very particular about the cousin she allows to view it.
I will do my best to edit out almost as much coughing as I can. And just so we know, the more I laugh, the more I cough. Because coughing, as does drinking dairy or eating dairy, laughing, as does eating or drinking dairy, puts me into a coughing spasm. So we'll try and I'll keep that.
Then I'm not going to talk down tonight.
Oh, you hush.
It's fraught with talk. Peril.
I know. For you. I know. We'll see. So this episode is part of our Drums of Autumn, not Dragonfly, as I wanted to say, read along. And to find out more about how to participate, Summer, where can they go to find out about what this is and how to become a part of our show?
Well, if you go to www.outlanderpod.com/DOA, that will take you to a link to our, I think it's on our Facebook page, which also contains a link which will bring up our Google Sheets, which has a calendar of the available chapters to see chapters that are available to provide your own commentary for if you wanted to join us for a read-along. And now on to our read-along. This week, we'll be starting part 3 of Dragonfly. Excuse me.
Don't make me use this bicycle horn. Stop it.
I love the bicycle horn.
I know
horn.
You do.
This week, we will be beginning part 3 of Drums of Autumn, entitled Pirates. But don't get too excited, because we have to meet Ahernia first.
I was like, wait, we have to do what?
Chapter 6, entitled I Encounter Ahernia.
One half step back to part 3, Pirates. Lorraine B. writes, Pirates, as the title of the third part of this book, sounded ominous and made me wonder why they'd want to go back to the ocean. ... I think most of us, when we think of pirates, think of the ones we encountered in Voyager. Time and time again, Diana surprises me. And now, as Summer said, on to the Ahernia. Lorraine B. writes, when I first read Drums, I asked myself how special could Ahernia be that it deserved a chapter title. Little did I know.
Well, when you see who it's attached to.
Or what it's attached to. Yeah, just kidding. Eileen P. writes, the chapter title, I Encounter Ahernia, makes me feel Claire's frustration with being out of her time, medically speaking. In the 1960s, Claire was a surgeon. She was able to knock patients out with anesthesia in order to perform surgery. Unfortunately, she didn't have that option in the 18th century. Due to her forethought, Claire has been using her penicillin syringes to heal people. They have been a lifesaver. Now, she is greeted with a dilemma. What happens when you encounter a hernia and surgery is not an option? Dun, dun, dun. I'm just kidding.
You leave the ball where it lies.
Summer. Yeah, you don't pick it up and start playing bocce.
Well, you try to splint it, and when that doesn't work, you tell him to get real drunk.
Oh, gosh. Well, okay, you're getting ahead of ourselves.
Oh, sorry. I'm very excited.
Jamie and Claire have decided to take a boat to get to River Run, where his uncle, Hector Cameron, lived, but because it will take 4 to 7 days via boat, and if they had gone, or if they go overland, it would be more than 2 weeks, possibly. Jamie says he already feels seasick, or so he says, and Claire's like, rivers don't have waves. Yeah. I was like, he's just burned by the water. He just doesn't. I think Jamie would get seasick in a still pool.
Well, there is no such thing as still water. Not really.
In a pool?
Even in a pool. Like if you were sitting on a floating.
I don't know what that is.
Well, I was going to say flotation and then I was going to say floating and then I said whatever I said. Anyway, so if you had like one of those relaxing kind of like lounge chairs, the floating
pool,
lounge
pool
chairs.
Floats. Oh, yeah.
It's never really still. You're always moving a little bit.
Okay, you might drift, but you're not going to bounce up and down. So I could see how just the movement period over the water could make him not feel
and
good.
You will also have to remember that so much of your experience is inside of your brain. And if you are conditioned and you look at water and remember being violently ill for weeks and months at a time, you are going to be scarred.
Yes.
And all water will make you think of the time when you almost died from vomiting.
I can go with that. But Claire says she has her needles just in case. Now, I had a question. We don't need to like talk about it, but because I'm also in the middle of a reread of or re-listen to of Echo. So I almost said, oh, did she blah, blah, blah? No, Ginger, you're way ahead of us. She did not have these needles made, did she? Or did she have these made? The ones she has now, the gold ones. She says her little gold needles. Did she get them from Willoughby? Or did she have them made in the colonies? Or because I don't think she would have had them with her when they were shipwrecked. I mean, everything was gone, right?
I have a feeling his little gold needles were still on the Artemis
which
shipwrecked, but it was still mostly intact. Everyone survived. It ran aground. It wasn't shipwrecked. Kind of makes you think it sank. And it was a shipwreck because it wrecked the ship, but it ran aground.
Sink is sink. But yeah, shipwrecked is when it basically kind of crashes or ends up on the shore and has like some damage typically to it.
Ran aground. Everyone survived. Odds are all the things on top of it that were on the boat are still on the boat. So the chances of those being the same pins that were so deeply embedded in his face last season are probably fairly high.
So because let's think about it this way. Let's say they weren't, and she did. They didn't get any money until chapter seven, like big money. They had these jewels, which don't help much, unless they can sell one. So she wouldn't have had money or gold.
And how is she supposed to explain
exactly.
to somebody who makes – who? First of all, where do you find a needle maker?
A goldsmith or a silversmith.
And acupuncture needles are so much smaller than like a sewing needle.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think it would be very hard to find someone to make those for her.
Yeah. Like I said, I was like, oh, this is cool. I just read about this. I'm like, no, you didn't, Ginger. That's in, or I just listened. No, you didn't. That's in book seven. So no spoilers except that Claire's alive. Yay. So she has her needles, which we believe are probably the ones from the Artemis. If you guys think otherwise or know otherwise, please let us know.
This week's episode is brought to you by Blue Apron. For 8 weeks, ending on February 26th, Blue Apron is teaming with Whole30 to bring you delicious recipes. Their menus will feature two Whole30 approved recipes each week, like Mexican spiced barramundi with avocado, Togarashi chicken lettuce cups, and avocado and kale and sweet potato salad. Kickstart your new year with Blue Apron and Whole30.
Now, Summer and I have had many episodes, I believe, sponsored by Blue Apron. They're one of our favorite sponsors because they support us so much. And the reason we love Blue Apron is not just because of the convenience they offer, the stuff they get. First of all, you don't, shouldn't, hopefully get a meal you don't like, because when you pop up and you select the weeks you want your delivery, hopefully you're choosing one that has something that you're fond of everything, right, Sam?
Absolutely. Plans they offer now, they're so much more customized. customizable to your own personal eating style. If in that week's offerings, you can't find 2 to 3 meals that are super exciting to you, you don't have to have it that week. You can take yourself out of the rotation for that week and pick it back up the next week.
So we love it because of the food, the fresh pre-portioned ingredients, and they don't just leave you hanging. They provide you step-by-step recipes along with all the ingredients and everything you need to make amazing meals.
Blue Apron is treating the Outlander podcast listeners to their first 3 meals, a $30 value with your first order if you visit blueapron.com/Outlander.
So check out this week's menu and get your $30 off with free shipping at blueapron.com/Outlander.
Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
We still had a little money and had saved their money by camping off the road at night on their way from after burying Gavin's body and making their way and passing the checkpoint. So one of the places that they had stayed, kind of camped out at, had been a rotted out old homestead, but there was a peach orchard there. They had eaten their fill and stocked up and as much as they could possibly carry as they left. And as they rode along, they sold as they went. And with this money, they were going to be able to buy provisions to make the journey upriver. So Claire is assigned to go get the provisions. And I think Fergus is with her. And Jamie and Duncan go to sell the wagon and the horses to get a boat, or at least maybe not buy a boat, but to make arrangements for them being on a boat.
Like to rent a boat or get a ride on a boat.
Yeah. And maybe a goldsmith. And maybe to sell a stone. And they take Rollo with them for protection, as Ian suggests. And the reason is not because they're necessarily in danger, because, you know, they're two dudes. There's no women. However, they are going, they're going to be in places, even if they're indoors talking to these people about things. You just don't know. Someone sees you walk into a goldsmith and then leave. They know you probably have business there. You either have money to buy something or money or gold to have made into something. So that I can see that. So just by the fact that someone sees you walk into a goldsmith, right? It's potentially dangerous. So I can see that. So Claire ends up, besides all the provisions, she also gets some lace and ribbon. And she tells Fergus, they're not to look like ragamuffins when they meet Jamie's relatives. Lorraine B. writes, the chapter starts off benignly enough with everyone going off to shop for or sell important items so they can continue their journey upriver to Cross Creek and Aunt Jocasta. Very quickly, we're immersed in the heat and humidity of Wilmington with visions of Claire's hair escaping her hat and a sweating shop girl. As Claire chooses ribbons for everyone, it's not hard for me to envision those handsome men with their hair tied back in those colors. Me either. Eileen P. writes, I laughed out loud when young Ian told Jamie to take Rollo with him for protection. I'm wondering if Drums of Autumn will call for a hashtag always take a Rollo slogan. That's cute. As Jamie comes back with Duncan, they meet John Quincy Myers.
I love him.
A very tall man.
I've always loved him. He's such a character.
He's but he's so honest and open. And like, there's not, at least what we get from him in his description and his actions and his words, there's like no subterfuge about him. He is who he is.
He is. And also,
and that's all that he is.
That's right. He's like Popeye. I am what I am. And that's all that I am. But I could not help but in my brain while listening to this today, trying to envision who they might cast as him. And I was thinking,
supposed to be like hella tall, like 6'7".
I wonder if I could finish the sentence, but I'm wondering now.
Oh, sorry.
Before I was wondering if the guy who plays the Hound is available from Game of Thrones now, because he would be bloody perfect.
Is he a big dude?
He's a big dude.
I mean, I know he's a big dude. Is he like six? Is he taller? Okay. It doesn't matter if he's taller than Jamie in the book.
He just has to be taller than Sam.
Sam. Exactly. Sam is 6'3".
I'm pretty sure he's stupid tall. Game of Thrones.
I'm guessing he's about 6'3", 6'4".
He is 6'6". And I swear to God, he would be so perfect for this role.
Oh, I hope so. That would be... Lord have mercy. That would be so fun. And he's such, oh my gosh, he's so hysterical. Okay.
That was hysterical.
We love, I know, we love us some John Quincy Myers. So whenever I say John Quincy Myers, even though the character is nothing like him because of all the syllables, I think of John Rhys Myers, whatever, or the three names, I guess. So he's a very tall man. And he said, as they introduce themselves, at least Claire and him, Jamie kind of walks over later on. As they're speaking, introducing themselves, he takes Claire and he kisses her hand as a greeting. And he tells her that he can tell she is a healer by the smelling of her hand. And he goes straight, just like a lot of people do when you find, and I'm guilty of this. I mean, not straight to that point, but I might bring conversation around to something. But just like so many people do, and it's such a natural thing, when you find out someone's a doctor or a nurse, you go, yeah, so my mom has this thing on her foot. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but never my balls.
Well, like, that's a good legit thing.
I don't have any balls, but it my first instinct, let's flip it. Okay? I don't have balls. Let's flip it. So I'm a woman because I'm not a man, but let's say I'm a woman and I'm the first, you know, dude I run into in the middle of the street in some strange town, in the middle of the street, mind you, middle of the street. I meet this dude and I'm like, hey, you look like you're a doctor. Could you look at my labia? Because there's this really weird thing going on down there.
I was expecting you to play Claire and the dude. I didn't expect you to play opposite.
Oh, that's what I said. Let's flip it. Like, I couldn't imagine like some dude like meeting some woman for the first time.
Wait for it. Just to be specific, the middle portion of my left one.
Right. I think I'm growing another labia.
Do women get inguinal hernias in around that area, or is that in the side crotch?
It's not in the side crotch. I don't think we get inguinal hernias like that because we have a bunch of junk down there. I think we have more junk down there between our intestines and
So our hernias are usually like abdominal.
I believe so.
I've heard them be like umbilical hernias.
Yeah.
Because I've watched Dr. Kat, Dr. Kat, Medicine Woman, the wonderful plastic surgeon who's on Snapchat and everywhere. And she's, first of all, she's hot. And yes, I like dudes. But she's crazy. I mean, she's a plastic surgeon, double board certified, blah, blah, blah. And I watch a lot of her stuff because, as you know, I don't bring popcorn, but I don't mind watching, as long as it's not facial or knee, I don't mind, or I should say nose or eye or mouth or knee, I don't mind watching surgeries, animal or human. And she doesn't do the whole thing, but they don't like show them cutting her open or, no, I guess they do. But anyway, I've seen a lot of tummy tucks and, you know, how they bring together, you know, after a woman, not all women, but many women get their abs will separate once they're the linea alba will kind of separate. And so what she does is that's part of the repair. And then as she does the tummy tuck, she'll pull the skin down, cut a circle over the new place for the belly button. She leaves the belly button actually connected, the skin of it, connected to the musculature, raises up all the skin, pulls the skin down, anchors it, cuts the extra off, and then cuts a hole above where the belly button is so it pops out. It's really cool to watch. But anyway, sometimes she does this surgery not just to fix, you know, some people lost a lot of weight, have extra skin, all kinds of reasons, had a kid, whatever it is. But sometimes they do this in conjunction with a hernia repair. And you can see, even in the pre-op photos, that even just in their plain skin, you know, not even opened up, you can see the a little poochie thing coming out of like around their belly button area, but not through it, just like underneath it or something.
Did you say poochie or coochie?
Oh, Lord Summer. I said poochie.
just curious.
Oh, now, Lord.
I did a Google search, which I swear one of these days the federal government is going to look at my Google search and think that there's something seriously wrong with me. Hernias in women. So can a woman have an inguinal hernia? Hernias in women can cause chronic pelvic pain, and hernia repair is very effective. They develop due to natural weakness in the internal inguinal ring. Hernias in women and children. Let me look at this. They say a woman can get a hernia while she's pregnant because it pushes down. The weight of the baby pushes down. Inguinal hernia. Yeah, it's typical for women to have non-palpable or occult inguinal hernias. These can only be adequately evaluated laparoscopically. Diagnosis is suspected by pain distribution or tenderness over the internal ring. Symptoms include pain in the lower abdomen or groin when lifting, coughing, and sneezing with radiation into the labia majora and anterior thigh. The neurological nociceptors include the genital branch of the genofemoral nerve, the iloinguinal nerve, the femoral nerve, or all of these. Patients may have indirect, direct, femoral, or a combination of these three. Indirect inguinal hernia is the most common hernia in women. It is congenital and due to the non-closure of the processus vaginalis. Tissues protrude through the internal ring that passes down the inguinal canal, a variable distance with the round ligament. Direct inguinal hernia is acquired and is the second most common inguinal hernia for women. And femoral hernias occur more commonly in women than in men. They are produced by a protrusion of preperitoneal fat or viscous through a weak transversalis fascia and into the femoral ring and the femoral canal.
So he's asking Claire about his hernia thing. And just about this time, Jamie comes over and he's like, "Hi, my name is Jamie Fraser. How can I help you?
Is there a reason you're showing your balls to my wife?"
Or want to, yeah. So they all greet each other. And we find out through the conversation that indeed Uncle Hector has died.
Is deed.
But Myers says he can get them to River Run. Claire diagnoses Myers' inguinal hernia and says to fix it, she'll need to cut. And please don't drop trow here in the street.
But can we talk about how grande it is that she just happens to meet the person who can, well, not only needs her.
Oh, who can help them?
Can help them.
Dude, I almost want to, I'm not going to, but I almost want to give up grande because it's almost like every other page.
I know. But they were actively looking for him, this person, clearly.
They were looking for John Myers?
Yeah. Didn't Jamie was saying I'm looking for Myers? And he goes, "I might be. It depends on if you're, you know."
Oh, so, okay. They didn't say, "Okay, I'm going to go get provisions. I'm going to go look for a boat." Before he even said or could be looking for Myers, he had to get information from somewhere. And he was told Myers was their man, right?
Right. Right. And Claire bumps into this dude on the street. And then I think Jamie comes up later and he goes, "Hey, do you know a so-and-so Miss so-and-so Myers?" And he's like, "Oh, yeah, that's me." But the odds of the dude who runs into Claire has a giant extra ball hernia thing and is wanting to have assistance with it all in one same person. I mean, it's a Gabaldonian grande.
The best line of the chapter. And Jamie says, quote, "What is it about to Sassenach, I wonder?" Unquote. And then, quote, "What is it that makes every man you meet want to take off his breeks within 5 minutes of meeting you?" Unquote. And then she has a very nice retort. She's like, "I don't know. If you don't know, I don't know." Lorraine B. writes, "As with many of Diana's characters, John Quincy Myers is larger than life. Literally."
Well, I was going to say, literally.
He leaps off the page in height, with Claire being able to press her nose into his navel should the urge strike her. His hands dangle level with her elbows, and he's got a big purple thing just behind his balls that's almost as big as one of them, and he wants to take off his ragged buckskins in the middle of town to show Claire. What a mental sight. Eileen P. writes, "I found out there was actually a John Quincy Myers. However, he was born in 1877. Just wondering if herself found the name and decided to use it. Regarding the Highland connections. Highlanders established family connections as a way of networking and protecting themselves. This linking of family connections is not only a Highlander practice. I remember reading a book that took place in Africa. It showed strangers meeting, then going through their ancestors until they found a common ancestor. This link provided protection, safe passage, help, etc., because they were family." So, back to the chapter. Claire had found them a potential boat through Myers' connections. Jamie had found a potential gem buyer, and an invite to a dinner where Governor Tryon would be at a man's home or named Lillington. But the target of Jamie's was Baron Penslaw, who might be their buyer of a gemstone. He needs Claire there as a potential distraction, so he lets her get cleaned up. He's got an investment toward the sale of the stone. He got, I think the goldsmith, someone gave him some money toward, no, it was Cousin Edwin, I think, or Edward, whatever, gave him a, I guess an investment, but toward the sale of a stone. So he got Claire a new gown. Clean and dressed, Claire eschews any type of hair covering, but does say she'll go with the ribbon. Jamie, also washed and freshly clothed, just in time, brings in a gold chain for her to wear. On it, mounted, a ruby. The reaction from the seamstress is hilarious. She's like, not having it with Claire, not really impressed. And then Jamie like comes in with this gold necklace and this huge booty ruby. And she's like,
He didn't have any booty rubies. He had a booty sapphire.
Booty, not booby, Summer.
It's a booty.
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 Yeah. And instead of saying huge ass, I'm saying huge booty. So stop it.
I'm just saying the sapphire was in his booty, not the ruby.
I didn't say in his, Summer. That's gross. And the sapphire is with someone else. And they're off. Eileen P. writes, regarding, and okay, so they had a discussion. So I don't, you know, write down every single individual discussion or anything. But I'm glad Eileen wrote about it. It's very interesting. So Claire, when she was trying her dress on or putting her dress on, asked the seamstress about the quality of the silk. Now, Eileen P. writes, regarding the silk made in America, I've always marveled about American ingenuity. Without it, where would we be? In Drums of Autumn, Claire learns her silk was made in South Carolina and costs half of that of China silk. Importing is expensive, so a woman, Mrs. Pinckney, decided to raise silkworms, and the American silk industry was established. That is pretty fascinating.
And that was Chapter 6. Next, we will move on to Chapter 7, entitled Great Prospects Fraught with Peril.
Jamie and Claire are attending that dinner at the home of a local in the presence of Governor Tryon, as well as a rich German named Baron Pensler, whom they hope might be enticed to purchase one of their stones. Diana's various topics of dinner conversation are very much on target with the times. One of the biggies is taxes. And just remember where we're at, the colonies, when we're at, the time just barely pre-revolutionary American colonies. And I mean, like the Boston Tea Party, what? That was over taxes. Well, not just taxes without representation, but it was over taxes. So it's so fun or interesting to read this. You don't have to be an American to appreciate the historical interest in this. But as an American, it is a little, I don't know, maybe we have it. I don't think we have a necessarily unique view on it, but our experience, because this is, you know, we learned this in, I don't know about grade school, but we definitely learned it in young school when we were young. And Claire is doing her job.
Yeah, but could you imagine only being taxed at 2%?
Oh, Lord. I know. And she like had a hilarious moment there. She was like, oh, gosh.
She's like, quote, they were so upset about surely, 2%. Where's that fiery rebellion in the people that are now being taxed, however much they were being taxed in the 40s or 60s?
Quote, surely everyone is interested in taxes, I said, turning slightly sideways so as to display my bosom to the best effect, unquote. Erica B. writes, Mr. Stanhope doesn't sound like a person I'd want to be at dinner with all of this hemorrhoid talk. What I find more interesting is that Claire didn't jump in and offer any suggestions, not even the mention of witch hazel. I think it is found in the area. The dinner meal is quite a scene with Stanhope choking on his meal. I think it was like a whole crab. I Googled the Heimlich maneuver and it wasn't brought about until 1974. Too bad Claire left the 20th century so soon. So one of the things that I think the reason she didn't offer anything about how to treat hemorrhoids or anything was because sometime also during dinner when Mr. Stanhope was choking, obviously if it came to like if he passed out or was, you know, truly in danger, she was prepared to help. She always would. But this was not her night. She didn't want to bring undue attention to herself. And she says in the chapter, she was like looking around for a knife. Remember that? She's like, oh, God, I hope I don't have to do a tracheotomy here. So she's ready. She's not anti.
She's like, I don't want to cut his balls.
Oh, God.
But I will totally slice into this dude's throat at the dinner table without any qualms.
Because the dude will die. Oh, well, he probably would have passed out by then, but yeah. So she is absolutely not anti-help, but she doesn't want to bring undue or need attention to herself without absolute necessity. We learn that a man named Philip Wiley, who is there, is a dandy. He wears a wig and he also has a very sweet star-shaped beauty mark. And his face is powdered, as dandies do. Claire asks about newspapers in the area. Remember that Jamie had his printing press in Scotland. And we find out there are two. Now, one was regular and publishing, and he might stop, Stanhope says. He may have been warned. He may have been warned by the Committee of Safety because it's not very safe. As you know, again, pre-revolutionary America is a dangerous place for pretty much everyone, right? It's, if you're a loyalist, it becomes more dangerous for you. But as the war approaches, it's dangerous for everyone. But yeah, for printers, I mean, you can make a buck, but it can go bad and go sideways really quickly.
It can, but I found it interesting that he when he was talking about the printers, he was saying, you know, most of the printers don't even, or they don't even all believe what they're printing. It's just a business. Not all of the people were, you know, seditious, looking for aiding in an uprising. They're just trying to make a living.
Now, Claire asks about their political leanings and about Jamie's family at River Run. The Baron likes Jamie's Aunt Jocasta. Quote, since many years, I am the dear friend of Mrs. Cameron and her husband, unfortunately dead, unquote. Now, yes, I mean, that's funny, but the reason I took note of that, Summer, I'll say it again. Listen to this as a German speaker and as an English speaker. What stands out to you? Since many years, I am the dear friend of Mrs. Cameron and her husband, unfortunately dead.
Sentence structure?
Yep. What about it?
It's not an English sentence structure.
No, it's not. But what part of it specifically?
Since many years.
Sehr gut, mein Schätzchen. Du hast es nie vergessen. Yeah. So in German, that's a literal translation. In English, we don't say since many years. We understand what you're trying to say, but that's not, you know, a native English speaker's way of expressing that. We would say for many years, right?
And it wouldn't be the first thing we say. That would be...
No, exactly. Exactly. It would be later on. Like, I've been enamored of them for many years, or I've loved them since 1922, whatever. Usually we put time and dates, typically later. German puts time, expressions of time and or dates, typically at the beginning of an expression. So yeah, I thought it endeared him to me. I thought it was very sweet. Since many years, because literally the literal translation of that in German would be seit vielen Jahren, since many years. That makes me laugh. So I thought it was very sweet. I wonder if by this time, so she's on book four, Diana, knowing her character is German, reached out to Barbara Schnell, the German translator, for ideas of how to naturalize this German's English speech.
Here's a question for you, Ginger. Do you feel torn when watching
World War II movies?
Yeah. And or like Indiana Jones. You find them so endearing when they have German speech patterns, and
I love the language and the people. It doesn't mean I love the Nazis.
I didn't say you love Nazis. Well, I feel torn.
You came up with two examples that included Nazis.
That's all that we have in American cinema.
Well, I will say, and I mean, it kind of still is Nazi-ish, but The Man in the High Castle, you start to feel sad for some of the Nazis. Not because they're, you know, yeah, they're taking part in a really bad thing, but they are also brainwashed. And the regular people, like the families and then the regular citizens who are not part of the hierarchy, you know, are born and bred to believe in this. And so they, without knowing anything else, believe this and act it out. But there are those in the hierarchy, as the dude played by Rufus Sewell, I forget his name, Captain someone. Rufus Sewell is hoty patoty, by the way. I sat next to him 2 years ago. Well, in 2016.
Stop talking like that. You're creeping me out.
Anyway. No, but he... Yeah, so no, Summer, I'm not a Nazi sympathizer. Get over it.
Hey, don't put words in my mouth. Don't put words in my mouth. I never said that.
So the Baron Pelzner? Did I say Pelzer or Pelzner? I can't get this wrong. Come on. It's the one German thing. Pensler. Put the N in the wrong place. Pensler. Baron Pensler examines Claire's stone, and by that we mean her burbs. And be careful what you ask. Claire, finding a particular dish delicious, asked what it was. The answer? Soused hog's face.
I mean, as long as it's not delivered to her the way that the sturgeon was, I can't imagine that you...
That was hysterical and gross.
I can't imagine that you can really complain. Most...
How were vegetarians... There couldn't have been vegetarians in the 18th century. It's not possible.
No, there could have been, but it was not something that was a widely followed option the way that it is now. But you would think about it. There would be months out of the year where you would have limited food.
That's true. You eat whatever smoked meat or anything you could have stored. Erica B. writes, at the end of the dinner scene, Claire really will eat all sorts of food before she asks what's in it, won't she? She is braver than I. After dinner, Claire is happy to retire. She goes and I meant to write it down, but I didn't. And there is a phrase in the chapter that I think I'm going to make the episode title. It's like peaceful, and it's four words. It's like peaceful and something and naked and quiet. It's how she was when she got back to the room. She took her dress off so she could cool down. It was peaceful around her. It was quiet. There was no one there. And there was one other word. I'm like, that is the perfect, that is how you want to, not you, Summer, but that is like the best way to be. And not so much about the naked, but just like you're relaxed and you're alone and you just have peace. Sometimes I think everyone can use a little bit of that. The dinner attendees begin to leave. And after they'd gone, she gets dressed again and goes out in search of Jamie. I spies with my little eyes.
And her little ears.
And her ears, mostly, yeah, both. Jamie speaking with Governor Tryon. The governor gets serious. He describes how North Carolina has loads of riches, but it's not reached the level of prosperity of its neighboring colonies. He mentions a system of land grants. Jamie mentions he's heard of them, but that it's only for white male Protestants. Gov tells Jamie to read between the lines, basically. Quote, what is not asked need not be told, unquote. Jamie had mentioned the word Jacobites. Tryon gets serious. Quote, these men will be required to swear an oath of loyalty to the crown if they have not already done so, unquote. Jamie takes his leave and says he will consider the offer. And Claire scurries back to the room to meet Jamie. So she's not necessarily thinking that Jamie doesn't know she's there, but she doesn't want the governor to see her or see Jamie see her and all that stuff. So, or know that anyone else has overheard. So I know I kind of glossed over it there, but basically that whole thing about the land grant, the governor was saying, look, I recognize you. You can use something. You want a place. And plus, he has connections. So that's why he wants to like make a deal with Jamie, even though he's not technically supposed to because Jamie's a papist, right? So look, we have this system of land grants.
Forget the system of land grants. He has a system of hierarchy of who's acceptable and who is from super acceptable to not acceptable at all. And he writes.
Well, yeah, he's like, well, you're not a Jew and you're not a Negro. You're fine.
Yeah,
exactly. Which is sick. But it is 18th century white colony central.
It's not unexpected, but it was jarring to read, but not unexpected. Yeah.
Oh, for him to say that? Yeah. The scary part is, and I think I put this in later, the scary part is, so the governor, okay, if the governor offers something to Jamie and Jamie accepts, they both get something out of it, right? So Jamie, as Claire describes in her like kind of rehash, in one foul swoop, she says, he regains everything he lost in Scotland, namely his land and people and a home, right? He doesn't necessarily have hundreds of people, but he can recruit them and he would be their leader, if you will. Maybe not their chief, but he would be the leader of that land grant. That would be his land. And they would rent from him. And so what does Tryon get out of it? Well, Tryon and the colony, they get more land settled by supposedly, hopefully, good people and good tenants. Okay, that's a plus. The whole point is, because he really, I thought more like, not hierarchically, I thought more globally, and I thought of Tryon as some VP of sales, marketing, whatever. or of some person in a company, but typically sales, right? It's like you have to meet your quota. I'm not saying he had to like give away so much land, but he already said that neighboring, he's like, look, we're put to shame by all these neighboring colonies. We don't have a good port, so we can't bring slaves in that way. We have to bring them in over land, and it's hella expensive. So not only do we not have an easy place for some person to come in, to come bring the labor in is even more expensive. So they really, really need people, and not just to work, but also to settle. So by bringing in a person or people like Jamie, they are getting what the king wants, right? Because the king is in charge of the governor. That's who he's representing there. And the governor gets something that makes him look good. And the reason, besides Jamie, you know, hopefully wanting it, is because as Claire recognizes in their tete-a-tete, they're both soldiers and they recognize that in each other. And so regardless of Jamie's past, he knows that, and because Jamie is a Catholic and he's willing to, quote unquote, willing to overlook this, Jamie, or I think Claire said it, is right. All he has to do, if he's ever, even if he's not necessarily upset with Jamie, if he wants to give it to somebody else or, you know, say, do anything for any reason, or if he's not happy with Jamie for any reason, all he has to say is, oh my gosh, he hid from me the fact that he's a papist and everything is gone. So this is hella dangerous. So it's a lot for Jamie and Claire and everyone in their troop to get, and then people, you know, settle and spend their life's blood and whatever money they have to potentially settle some land. That's tenuous. That's on something that can be overturned, maybe not super easily, but on someone's whim. Now that person whose whim it is has a huge interest in keeping Jamie and his people there. So very unlikely that it would happen. The point is,
no, but if something does happen, he has him over a barrel. Yeah. And it's not, that's exactly. And it's not just, you know, the physical, I'm going to take this away from you. It's the overlying threat that will hang over him for every day that he owns that place.
Yeah, and then, exactly.
You know, and because of the time period that they are there, we know what's coming historically, and we know what's probably going to be expected of him historically.
Oh, gosh. Well, exactly. So that's another thing, is that Jamie, not just in the now time or in his time, and I don't think I said this, it's 1767, not only in their moment right then, but exactly right. So Jamie knows what's coming. He may not know the details, but Claire's told him as much as she can possibly tell him of what long-term will happen. And if and when, or no, sorry, when he has to stake his claim, right, and announce his loyalties, he at that point would risk potentially losing his lands, at least in the interim. So there's so much, because so much can be lost, so much can be gained. And it's just, and that's why ultimately, of course, understandably, he says, I will think on it. I'm not going to do this right now. Erica B. writes, I'm certainly glad I live in a time when it's perfectly reasonable to wander in my house in something other than hot as hell fancy dresses all the time. I would have passed out from heat exhaustion if I were in her situation. Claire mentioned that when she touches the ruby, it's warmer than her own skin, but thinks she must be imagining it. Curious that this bit of foreshadowing doesn't play out until much later down the road. And the reason I left this in is because it's quite vague. And also, number two, I wasn't 100% sure which foreshadowing you were talking about. So if it doesn't mean that, I mean, I could be the totally ignorant one here, and obviously I am in some capacity, but does that trigger
always.
You? Oh, thank you. Does that trigger you immediately? Like, do you know what she's talking about?
The warmth of gemstones?
Not the warmth of gemstones, specifically.
Oh, you know what that makes me think of?
What?
How it's warmer than her body.
Yeah.
I don't think it's this book, but do you remember in one of the following books, when one of the... Yeah, that's all. That's the only thing I can think.
That makes sense. Okay. Very interesting, Eric B. Erica continues, an offer to be a landowner and to settle down direct from the governor? That is amazing. I love that Jamie didn't even hesitate to ask about Fergus and Innes. So Duncan Innes. I'm like, who's Innes? Oh, Duncan. It's like Fergus and Innes. Just say Duncan because that's a first name and a last name and you're freaking me out, girl. When it was mentioned, they would need to be able to work the land, always thinking of others and not just himself. And I thought that was a good thing, too. The governor, again, you're right, Summer. The governor's like, okay, you have to be white, male, Protestant, right? Mm-hmm. And Jamie's like, look, okay, I'm white and male, but I'm Papist. I'm Catholic. And he's like, yeah, who cares? You're mm-hmm. fine. Yeah. You're white, you're male, you're good. And then he's like, well, what about people who work on the land or who have parcels of land, whatever? And he's like, oh, they just have to be like able-bodied, blah, blah, blah. And Jamie's like, okay, let me check this now. So I asked about me holding the ground. Let me check about this. I have my adopted son and I have a friend who was injured, da, 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 da. What about them? And he's like, oh yeah, pish posh. I mean, like everything he's doing, the governor's like, I don't care, dude. As long as they can handle it, you worry about it.
Right.
He's like,
yeah. I'm like, no, here's the bottom line. The governor doesn't give a about who Jamie brings on the property with him. He wants Jamie on the hook because he sees a leader. He sees a man with military background who has skills that he would like somebody under his command to have. So I think that he's at this point just being like, yeah, whatever. It's fine. Good. Let's do it. I want you. You're the one I want.
You're the one that I want. Ooh, honey.
I was not making a Grease reference. That was all you.
That's not, dude, you weren't making any Grease reference. When I heard the line, I think of the song. It has nothing to do with the musical. I wasn't even thinking Grease when I sang it. I'm very aural.
You are very anal.
Say it, Summer.
Oral.
Say it right.
Oral.
Not, no. Aural.
Aural.
You're making it worse.
You're very aural.
That's better. Thank you. Okay. So it's interesting, Claire's thoughts of the Book of Job. Quote, all those sons and daughters and camels and houses destroyed so casually and then replaced with such extravagant largesse. One camel was much like another, but children seemed a different proposition. And while Job might have regarded the replacement of his children as simple justice, I couldn't help thinking that the dead children's mother might possibly have been of another mind about it. Unquote. And the reason I wrote that was not aiming anything toward Jamie, nothing accusatory, but at the fact of children lost and children gained. Can't go anywhere with that because I can't spoil anything, but I thought it was interesting to just note.
I mean, you literally can, but you won't.
But I won't. I'll go right up there and then exactly. Not go over the line. So we may come back to this later in the book, or maybe not. Claire is freaking out that in order to recruit the number of settlers the governor seems to want, Jamie would have to go to Scotland. And she reflects on the tombstone she'd seen there. She believes she will bury Jamie in Scotland, but there was no date on that tombstone. So who knows when? So just so we all remember together, dear listener, that was in Voyager. No, was that in Dragonfly? Dragonfly, right? In the book. Jamie comes in to the room where she was naked before and then not, and then probably halfway dressed again. Maybe, I don't know. And he knows, of course he knows, she had been eavesdropping. He confirms that the Baron had purchased a stone for 300 pounds sterling. And we experience the oath that Jamie had taken after Culloden. So that was probably on their release, I'm guessing. Not from Culloden, on their release from Ardsmuir. And I did not retype it. I don't need to. It's in the script. Yeah, because they give us scripts. It's in the text. So you guys can go read it. But that was kind of difficult to read. That was a lot. Erica B. writes, that oath is so heartbreaking to hear. All the Scots who had to suffer through it, my heart breaks for them. Perhaps he sees that Jamie has seen a thing or two and can deal with whatever is on some of this probably lesser quality land in the mountains. I mean, it does make you wonder what is wrong with it that he couldn't offer it to someone who met all of the criteria. Well, I think the answer to that is they just don't have people. They just don't have people. They don't have enough people.
They don't have people. And what they don't realize yet is how well the Scots are suited for the land they are given. Because if you've ever been to like the Great Smoky Mountains in North Carolina or the Blue Ridge Mountains in North Carolina, that entire area could double for Scotland and Scotland could double for it. So it has, while significantly warmer, I will grant you, it is topographically very similar.
The next morning in bed, they chat about the governor's offer. Jamie wonders why he made it. His concern is why the governor made it. He thinks it's because of his connections to the Camerons, who are wealthy and who are respected. And Jamie himself has few ties, and he's new, and he's not very well known. And he has no known, publicly known, loyalties. He's skeptical as to why the Baron offered him 3 times as much as the goldsmith did for the stone.
Because he can, and he's not trying to sell it.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. He wants to own it.
He's not trying to sell it because a goldsmith, it's like when you pawn something, you have to pawn it for less than it's worth so that you can make money on it. I've watched Pawn Stars.
Tryon recognizes Jamie as a soldier. There has been trouble with the locals in recent years with the regulators, which is a loose association of men who had taken offense at what they perceived as capricious and inequitable, at times illegal, behavior on the part of the Crown's appointed officials. They took matters into their own hands and had assaulted sheriff's deputies and accosted justices of the peace. So that's all from, it's not verbatim, which is why I didn't say quote, but it is a lot of the same language Diana used, and it's slightly paraphrased. I skipped some of the description, but she is all from Diana. Perhaps Tryon was looking to buy the loyalty of an experienced soldier, Diana writes. They chat about the other issues or non-issues. He's not known, and of course, that he's Catholic. Getting Jamie to take the land, they both get something out of it. But Jamie was the one who would suffer should Tryon change his mind. Erica B. writes, I love this scene in the bedroom. Chatting in the dark with the spouse in a bed is a time-honored tradition. Kari R. writes, I loved this chapter so much more after reading it again and listening to Davina narrate a few times. This chapter is full of hope for the future of our favorite couple. Having lost all in Scotland, Jamie is offered a land grant by the governor of the North Carolina colony, Governor Tryon. Claire compares Jamie to the biblical Job, who, having lost everything, has all that he has lost restored to him tenfold. The conversation held between Jamie and Tryon piqued my interest in finding out more about the history of Scottish immigrants and the settling of this particular colony, so I decided that this is the thread I'd like to follow in this chapter. According to www.northcarolinahistory.org, and we'll include the links in the show notes, North Carolina was a more popular colony to settle for Highland Scots than any other colony. When one thinks about it, it would make sense, as the hills and mountains of North Carolina would have been reminiscent of their native land. The influx of Scots to North Carolina began in earnest when Gabriel Johnson, the royal governor of North Carolina and a native Scotsman, encouraged 360 Highland Scots to settle in North Carolina in 1739. So Tryon was correct when he told Jamie that Scots had been settling in the Cape Fear region for 30 years. Governor Johnston later offered these Scotsmen a 10-year tax exemption for taking him up on his offer. Subsequent offers by Johnston attracted Highland Scots who had been forced to leave their homes due to increasing land rents and the Highland clearances that followed the Scots' defeat at the Battle of Culloden, when many Scots were forced to give up their land so that sheep could be raised. While there is no exact number, scores of Highland Scots migrated to North Carolina during the colonial period via Wilmington, where many received land grants from the government to settle in the upper Cape Fear region, the lower Cape Fear region having already been settled by lowland Scots. Ah, isn't that interesting? Gracious. In 1754, merchants from Wilmington had settled the river town of Cross Creek, Kari writes. I honestly had no idea that Cross Creek was a real place until I started doing this little bit of research. That Diana G. always trusts that she knows what she's talking about. The 1790 U.S. Census lists 150 inhabitants of the upper Cape Fear Valley who named Scotland as their birthplace. Highland Scots still spoke their native Gaelic language in their homes and churches where Presbyterian ministers conducted services in Gaelic. The use of Gaelic declined sharply after the Civil War and virtually disappeared as a spoken language by the mid-20th century. The state's Scottish history is still celebrated in North Carolina. Over 35,000 people attend the Highland Games at Grandfather Mountain every July. I'd like to go there sometime. We have to go there someday.
July.
We have to do a pod maybe not a pod tent, because I don't know if we can wrangle that, but we have to work with locals who have an Outlander themed booth or some kind of clan booth, maybe our own clan, who knows, just to be there, have a little meetup, you know?
I mean, I'm not opposed, but I would like to do it at some point. Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that was chapter 7. Join us next time when we will be discussing chapter 8, Man of Worth.
As always, you can join us to continue the conversation in our Facebook community. We'd love to have you join us there. And you can find us at outlanderpod.com/group. And we would be ever so grateful if you'd take a look at our Patreon page. If you love our show and you get, you know, entertainment out of it and you get a laugh or two maybe from Summer on my behalf, something like that, you know, and you would like another or a unique way of supporting us and our show, then give us a visit over at patreon.com/outlanderpod.
So again, join us next week when we continue our Drums of Autumn read-along. And if you want to find out how you can participate with our read-along, if you go to www.outlanderpod.com/DOA, you can find all of the information there.
Thank you, as always, so much for joining us. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at @outlanderpod.